I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the future of Indianapolis's neighborhoods. We're going to talk about what makes a neighborhood, what it takes to make a neighborhood thrive, and what can prevent neighborhoods from thriving. We're going to talk about all of this with guests Adam Tease, Director of the Indianapolis Department of Metropolitan Development, Lee Riley Evans, Executive Director of the Mapleton Fall Creek Development Corporation, and Debbie Morris of F.C. Tucker and the Metropolitan Indianapolis Board of Realtors. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I'm John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, Executive Editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the future of Indianapolis's neighborhoods. We've got a great group of guests, starting with Adam Tease, who is the Director of the Indianapolis Department of Metropolitan Development. Adam, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here, John. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. It's good to have you here. Lee Riley Evans, who is the Executive Director of the Mapleton Fall Creek Development Corporation. Lee, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the invitation.
Certainly. It's good to have you here. And Debbie Morris, who is with F.C. Tucker and the Metropolitan Indianapolis Board of Realtors. We're going to call that my board going forward because it's a little quicker. Debbie, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
It's good to have you all here. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, I want to start first this conversation really by talking about what a neighborhood is, how we define it. It's one of those words that has so many associations. That I think probably getting some definition at the start of the discussion would be a good idea. I'll start with Adam Tease.
It's a great question. Indianapolis is inherently made up with a diverse range of neighborhoods, and to some people that might be a collection of housing across a certain geographic area. It might be related to a specific institution. Often you might think Butler Tarkington is connected to Butler University or to some other institution. So I think in some terms, in some ways, the phrase neighborhood often is a little bit self-defined. It's a little hard to do that from a very hard geography standpoint. In some ways, though, we do that both through our CDC, Community Development Corporation, community, which does define some geographies. And then I think informally people do that through kind of neighborhood associations, if you will. And so in some ways we have multiple sets of what you might call a neighborhood. It is a little tough term to define for the city moving forward.
Well, and I'll throw the question next to Lee.
Okay.
Since actually you represent kind of a neighborhood development corporation, how did you arrive, how did Mapleton Fall Creek arrive as sort of a designated neighborhood?
Well, the neighborhood of Mapleton Fall Creek was designated by its residents, and that to me is the basics for identifying what a neighborhood is. You need to support those communities based on the people and the businesses that are in that community. And so as a result, the local places of worship, the six churches, and the neighborhood association as a whole created Mapleton Fall Creek Development Corporation. So there are some hard boundaries. There is 38th Street or Maple Road as our northern boundary. Meridian Street is our western boundary, and Fall Creek Parkway, as well as the waterway, is our southern and our eastern boundary. And so that designated community has been known as Mapleton Fall Creek since 1985 is when the Community Development Corporation started. But again, it was the basis of those places of worship as well as its residents that said, we want to focus on this geography and to identify this neighborhood for a value and for its assets.
Well, and in terms of, from the realtor's perspective, mm-hmm. from the real estate perspective, how How do you define neighborhoods?
Well, yeah, listening to them talk, it's interesting because when you're, if you go out into the suburban areas, it's very defined. It's by neighborhood. You pass through two stone columns and you've entered into your neighborhood. And that has, I think, morphed over time. When we think inner city and you know, where I think of Center Township and Marion County, it's more of the walkable, you know, where do you walk? People think of their neighborhood as, you know, where they walk or where they're going to drive to go to the cleaners or to the grocery store. So I think that's, you know, more of how you define it when you don't pass through an obvious, you know, boundary way.
And in terms of, again, keeping it with Debbie Morris for a second or two, in terms of driving real estate decisions and all that, how important is neighborhood to that part of the process, purchasing decisions, all of that?
Buyers often define where they want to go based on, I want to be in this neighborhood or near this neighborhood. I mean, having that definition is extremely important, I think, in the world of real estate.
And what defines, I'm going to throw this one to Adam Tease now, what defines a vibrant neighborhood? I mean, what qualities do we look for?
Well, I think there are qualities that are measurable and physical. Those are, Debbie, you referenced having a grocery store to go to, having a school to walk to, having a place of worship to attend. That has the mix of uses. I then think there are the more intangible, what makes a great neighborhood are kind of the inherent people relationships. So people who have been there a long time, people who have been able to have kind of a social network, if you will. And I think that social network can happen in urban settings, can happen in suburban settings. I will say in urban settings, we have a little bit tighter fabric of buildings, of walkability that allows you to have a little bit more of that street level interaction, if you will. So it does differentiate. I think you bring up a good point about kind of the suburban subdivision model, if you will, that's kind of become proxy for the term neighborhood. And they're not necessarily one and the same, but then again, it's a little tough to define beyond that point.
Well, and you also have infrastructure. You know, Lee mentioned the Fall Creek, the actual waterway. I mean, that's just one of those natural infrastructures. Major streets become sort of those defining boundaries for particular neighborhoods.
Well, and I guess what I'd start, I'm going to throw the same question to Lee that I did to Adam. And since you represent and deal with a specific neighborhood.
Correct.
What in your mind, and, you know, of your neighbors, presumably, consists of a really vibrant neighborhood? What things do you want for Mapleton Fall Creek?
Well, I think I'll take that in two parts. There's a question that talks about what defines it, and then there's also the question about what do you want. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the definition comes from the social and the cultural influences that happen in that community, and historically, where you've been able to walk or where you've been able to play creates a comfort and what memories are created for your space of living in with your community in that neighborhood. Now, what we would like to see for a neighborhood similar to Mapleton Fall Creek is that idea of placemaking. And oftentimes, we don't have the gateways or those stone columns that Debbie referred to entering our community. We have really an underappreciated place that we're trying to figure out how to identify specific places to attract residents to, as well as retain residents. We have some very long-standing seniors in our community, but we've got an inflow of younger residents moving into the neighborhood, some of those 20-somethings, if you will, some of the people that are identified as empty nesters. And so what we would like to see is more walkable community, something that incorporates the cyclist as well as a pedestrian into the development of an underappreciated place such as Mapleton Fall Creek. And so responding to some of those desires that you typically will have in those communities that you drive in between the stone columns or that you would normally associate with a more distinguished neighborhood like a Butler, Tarkington. We'd like to see some of those things happen to support the economic development and the enhancement of the social and the cultural assets in Mapleton Fall Creek.
We are talking about the future of Indianapolis's neighborhoods here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can shoot an email to us at nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I want to stay with you for just a moment, Lee. And you said, you know, you represent what is an underappreciated neighborhood. How do you go about getting people to appreciate the neighborhood more? I mean, what is part of that process, and why is that important?
Well, some of the efforts include continuing to talk about it so that we can start to create value for the space. We need to make sure that people understand that there is community policing happening. There is an attempt to change the perception as well as the reality of crime in the neighborhood. We want to partner with the city to improve some of the infrastructure. Some of that is happening, and more of it needs to continue so that there can be a response to the curbs and the sidewalks and the streets that have deteriorated. And so just creating a sense of value, focusing on the assets that are created, working to remediate the brownfields in the neighborhood, and just celebrating those pioneering spirits that are willing to come back, as well as celebrating those that have continued to stay and value and cherish their neighborhood.
We are talking about the future of Indianapolis's neighborhoods here on No Limits, and we've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Holly, who says, in Meridian Kessler, we have heard that a rail is going to be built straight down College Avenue. Why not Fall Creek, or is that just a rumor? Thanks. I think that one obviously is directed toward you, Adam Tease.
Good question. IndyConnect is the brand name that's been given to Central Indiana's long-range transportation planning process related to mass transit. It's very much in the news right now because the state legislature is considering allowing a referendum.
That is the subject of Thursday's show.
Great,
too,
good timing.
We'll have Ron Gifford. So thank you for the
very
plug.
Good timing.
Thank you for the plug, Adam.
Right now, as we speak, there are five basic corridors coming out of downtown that are under study. Mm-hmm. Those corridors basically head north, south, east, west, and then northeast. In terms of a specific alignment, I think the Facebook question was about College. It really hasn't been determined yet at this point. There are several different street corridors under consideration for that alignment.
And is Fall Creek under consideration? I think that was the other part.
Fall Creek really is a part of maybe an east-west segment that would run in that north-south area, but it, at this point, is really not a direct route, if you will, on Fall Creek.
Okay. Well, and I want to pick up on some of the points that Lee was making. The whole subject of neighborhood revitalization has been a big one in this city. I mean, I know neighborhoods historically, for as long as I can remember, complained that, you know, this is not specific to the Ballard administration. It's been pretty much any administration focused much more attention and energy on revitalizing downtown than the neighborhoods. What is the strategy for neighborhood revitalization in Indianapolis, Adam?
I think right now you're looking at a world where we now finally are starting to get some sense of leverage out of whether it's our federal dollars, whether it's the momentum of the neighborhoods themselves. We're not in the same place we were 20 years ago. 20 years ago, many of our urban neighborhoods really required kind of a core stabilization activity. We just understand what's going on here. Many of our neighborhoods are beyond that point now, and we're to the point where we can start to take and leverage, whether it's our local funding sources, Lee, you mentioned infrastructure, whether it's federal sources, community development block grants, home dollars, those are traditional housing and urban development sources, and then the good old-fashioned marketplace. So in some ways, the idea that these homes are having value above and beyond them being in just an older urban area, they now have desirability. So I think when you ask that question, the goal is now to start to mix the three of those in a much more concentrated and focused effort moving forward.
And how, Debbie Morris, how important, you know, from a real estate perspective, is neighborhood revitalization?
Well, this is an exciting topic for me just because as a realtor, economic development and growth of a city is inherent in a strong industry and a strong real estate industry. So I think no one would argue that to have a vibrant, growing region, you have to have a strong core, you know, and that core is that Center Township, Marion County area that we're talking about today. And I think the proof where realtors are very involved and committed to this, my board does, I think, a great job of reaching out to the different associations and community groups in supporting them and doing what we can to support this effort of, you know, bringing that growth back to the core.
We are talking about the future of Indianapolis' neighborhoods here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Adam Tease, Lee Riley Evans, and Debbie Morris. You're listening to No Limits. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the future of Indianapolis's neighborhoods. My guests are Adam Tease, who is the director of the Indianapolis Department of Metropolitan Development, Lee Riley Evans, who is the executive director of the Mapleton Fall Creek Development Corporation, Debbie Morris, who's with F.C. Tucker and is the immediate past president,
yep,
of the Metropolitan Indianapolis Board of Realtors, MIBOR. I can say all of you have titles that, you know, no one who works in radio developed for you. They just don't flow off the tongue. But you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten actually a tweet from a listener identified as Small Box. I'm assuming that's Small Box Consulting, saying, and it's more a comment than a question, it's not just about the properties, it's also about the people and the culture. How much of that is part of the process for you? You were alluding to some of that, Lee Riley mm-hmm. Evans, in building a sense of community.
Oh, I think it's critical. You can't move forward without people. Though they may be the tangible as well as the intangible, it is the network that's created that helps make those connections. They are the core that's stabilized, that Adam was speaking to earlier. When we talk about neighborhood stabilization of Mapleton Fall Creek and the dollars that we were able to leverage, as well as have supported the city to respond to some vacancy and some abandonment in the neighborhood, it was the people that make the difference. It is the establishment of some social networks and some gathering spaces for those people to influence their culture and to expand on those ideas. So it's critical to a neighborhood.
Well, and I'll throw that back to Adam Tease, because I would think that from your perspective, that would be one of the biggest challenges, is how you respect and preserve kind of the spirit of these individual spaces, while at the same time trying to treat all of them fairly.
It is the challenge. I think in some ways, Indianapolis is almost 400 square miles in size. We are a massive city when it comes to geography. So it is not a condition where we have unlimited resources to allocate to each and every neighborhood in easily definable ways at each time. So we always try and wrestle with that. And that's why I mentioned earlier that we're always trying to work with the community at hand, but we're also trying to identify what's the market doing, what's happening, not just ignoring those forces, so that we can be kind of cognizant of those and ride those waves when they're there, because we need those forces in place to be able to not only revitalize but enhance. It's one thing to revitalize a neighborhood; it's another thing to kind of put that brand on it that it lasts kind of indefinitely. So it's no longer a revitalization story. It's just a great neighborhood. It's just a place you want to live.
Right, you sustain that community.
Lee, Riley, yes, right. Yeah. Well, and Debbie Morris, since you're the one probably presumably selling these neighborhoods to people who come in. How do you go about describing? Like if someone were looking for, you know, a place to live in an urban setting and all of that, how would you go about describing Mapleton Fall Creek if they were looking at properties there? What would you say about it?
I mean, the first key is that you have an organized association made up of homeowners. So that tells a buyer that there's a group of people that care about a particular area and, you know, all fighting and wanting the greater good for that neighborhood. So that, I think, is a big identifier. And if you see people, you know, the first impression is the outside of every home and every green space. So as people drive around, if they see people taking care of their properties and they see a commitment to, you know, making it something that they would be proud to move to, you know, that's what buyers are looking for. And something that MIBOR was involved in was the Building a Living Legacy project with the Bonner Center. And kind of spinning off on what we were talking about, I think to make it long-term, you have to have that grassroots residence commitment to making it better, because the city can come in and identify a neighborhood and say, okay, we're going to redevelop this. But if you don't have that grassroots commitment to, yes, we all want to make this better, I don't see it having that long-term sustainable success like we've seen, you know, with some of the neighborhoods that have, you know, started that way and the commitment is there.
We are talking about the future of Indianapolis's neighborhoods here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You also can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Adam Tease, I'm going to try to take this question from the other end. We've talked about what is a healthy neighborhood and all of that. What are some of the signs that a neighborhood's in trouble?
I think there are many. I think the dilemma that we often face with some of our, let's call them aging neighborhoods, mm-hmm. is the reality of time. So you have a neighborhood that 50 years ago or even 100 years ago was state of the art. It mm-hmm. was the suburbs. Mm-hmm. We're sitting in an area here at 16th Street that mm-hmm. in essence was the suburbs at one point. Mm-hmm. So it was new. And so with anything comes time and age. So you have a dilemma that comes with the maintenance. Deb, you mentioned upkeep and people's mm-hmm. attention. That takes time and effort. We live in a busy world, fast food restaurants, pull-through drive-throughs, Twitter, Facebook, you know, mm-hmm. quick. Well, aging buildings take time. So I think some of the signs of when you have a neighborhood that is struggling is when that maintenance starts to struggle, that mm-hmm. basic kind of upkeep starts to struggle. I think you also see signs when those social networks start to break down. Lee, you mentioned churches, places of worship, schools. So we're always focused on those areas to kind of continue to monitor those and try and enhance those, because I think moving beyond just maintenance, then it then becomes a kind of the market is often perception. And so you have to deal with perception. You can't just ignore it. Mm-hmm. You always have to say, what's the market saying, and respond. You can't ignore your customer. Mm-hmm. You can't just say the customer's wrong. You have to say, how do we meet the market? How do we provide what the market wants?
Well, and I want to pick up on the spirit of that one comment, though, about the people and the culture. What, you know, that, and you alluded, and I think you and Lee both have alluded to the idea that if there's a breakdown in that sense of community, what things define that kind of, constitute that kind of sense of community? Is it the church? Is it the schools? Is it having a marketplace that you can walk to? Is it, you know, some sort of gathering center? I'll go with Lee, since you made eye contact yeah. at the wrong moment.
I'll say yes, 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 and yes. It's all of those things. It's the social and the culture, just as important as the transportation and the connectivity, just as important as the environment, just as important as the services or the amenities. All of those pieces feed into the holistic approach of sustaining a community. We've got to make sure that one is not necessarily more important or more attended to than the other. It has to be a concerted approach to address each of those.
Adam Pease.
I'd add to that you just also start to look at demographic trends. Mm-hmm. You look at how we live and work. I'm a father of three young children. I have a mm-hmm. five-year-old, a three-year-old, and a one-year-old. Our life revolves around the YMCA and going to school. And so mm-hmm. those are those institutions that are important to us. So as your neighborhood starts to take on a character of that nature, family, those institutions matter. A lot of our neighborhoods are taking on actually households that aren't families, that don't have kids. Mm-hmm. That's actually a growing demographic. Where you have a household that doesn't have children, or the baby boom that's coming back after not having or after the children have left the house. So I think that part of when I say the market, I'm talking about being cognizant of the demographic trends that are out there and not ignoring those just because you want it to be like it was 100 years ago or want it to be like it was 50 years ago. We kind of have to deal with what we have. And
right. Our community is definitely different than it was in the 1900s yes. when it was first yeah. established. Yeah. Right.
Well, and I'm going to throw that. I hesitate and I feel like I'm violating the spirit of the question here to attempt to attach a value to any of those things. But, you know, when we talk about some of these indicators of a community's spirit and vitality, the schools, the churches, having a marketplace, whether people are out, in terms of real estate values, Debbie Morris, what drives the value the most?
If I had to prioritize them, I would probably say schools would be at the top of the list, because even if people don't have children, they understand the importance of quality schools really bring together quality neighborhoods. So that would be my ranking.
We've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Kara. Says, love the topic. We live in the SoBro area, just south of Broad Ripple. We want to live in an urban area where we could walk, wanted to live in an urban area where we could walk and have access to the Monon, plus all the wonderful local restaurants, etc. We love where we are because of the culture of the area. Everyone walks, runs, bikes, and it is a good mix of people. The hardest part of deciding where to live in an urban setting was the affordability, safety, and schools. We decided to send our children to a local Catholic school, which made our ability to afford a bigger home difficult. Since we have children, being a pioneer in a developing area was not an option. We wanted to have our children play outside without fear. Adam Tees, how much of that, she's really talking about a safety question there. Mm-hmm. How much of that drives the whole issue of neighborhood revitalization?
It drives it. It's perception is reality when it comes to safety. And I think, unfortunately, that's not necessarily... if you go out into certain neighborhoods that might have a difficult perception, it might not be the reality. Mm-hmm. The city is extraordinarily committed to that concept, that with kind of perception comes the world of value. I'd follow Debbie's comment with right after schools is safety. Mm-hmm. My wife would be just like the caller or listener mm-hmm. that sent the note. Want to care for, as I would, mm-hmm. our children, and you wouldn't want to take any risks. So there's a risk aversion issue with neighborhood mm-hmm. redevelopment. You have to be cognizant of people's risks, and you have to work
and
as
their
hard
sense
as,
of their risk,
you
too,
bet, and you have to yeah. work as hard as humanly possible to manage and, in essence, negate that risk, because people make investments like they do in the stock market, just like they do with their housing, mm-hmm. based on risk.
And I'll also offer that the importance of people comes back to assessing mm-hmm. that risk as it relates to the policing and making sure that your neighborhoods are safe and vital from a crime perspective, because it's going to require neighbors knowing who should be in their neighborhood. It's going to require neighbors calling the police when they recognize that someone is in their neighborhood that shouldn't be there. We have to get beyond just the tactical policing of law enforcement, but start doing some community policing and making sure that we are working with each other to combat the crime that's in these communities.
Adam Tees.
Because there simply never will be enough resources mm-hmm. to address every single concern. There just won't be.
Right.
That's
mm-hmm.
just the reality.
We are talking about the future of Indianapolis's neighborhoods here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Dave, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Certainly. Your question, please.
I actually have a two-parter. coming from being raised in the suburbs, my wife and I were both raised on the north side and in Hamilton County, and we both agreed when we bought our first house to discontinue that. We didn't want any part of that, so we moved. We ended up on the Far East Side, actually, but we were really interested in one of the older neighborhoods, like the ones that you guys are talking about. So I'm curious, since getting people into neighborhoods is so important to bringing them back, what are some strategies to bringing people either out of the suburbs into the city or new people that aren't from the metro area to begin with to settle in the city as opposed to the suburbs? And then the second part, or 1A, if you will, is directed specifically to the realtor.
Debbie Morris, yes.
Yeah. It was our experience that our own realtor and friends who have moved into the area, if they were on, we're 20-somethings, we were immediately taken to the suburbs. That was the first instinct. We didn't have children at the time. Our friends did. And my question is there any, like, group of people or a specific strategy to not have that happen anymore, so that somebody doesn't immediately get taken to Carmel or Greenwood or whatever? Do you ever take people to urban neighborhoods first, or at all, if they have kids or will have kids soon or anything?
Thanks very much for the call and the questions, Dave. We'll try to get some answers for you. I think
you.
We will start with Debbie Morris first. We'll take them in reverse order.
Right.
Okay, we'll start with, as a realtor, you know, if you're presented with someone like that, what do you show them if they're new to the area in particular? Where do you show them first?
Right. Well, you know, it starts off with hopefully lots of questions to determine what is important to you. So based on that needs assessment, then, you know, hopefully they show you all the areas that would meet those requirements. The reality is, I think there's just some stereotyping that goes on, and it's something that, again, as an association and just as a realtor community, we're very sensitive to that. And I guess I would look to my good friend here, Adam, to talk about what the city's doing, but that is that your question is one of the core reasons that we're here and that we're talking about these issues, because with families, the stereotypical demographic that has gone to the suburbs is the family, and why have they gone out there, and what can we do to bring them back to the city core?
Adam Tease, well, we'll take the first part of Dave's question there real quickly, which was to reframe it. Yeah, what are we doing to try to bring people back into the city?
Well, I think let's go back to this idea of your budget, your personal budget, what you have to spend on housing, what you have to spend on transportation, food, clothing, schooling. We had that previous caller who mentioned because they chose a private school, didn't have as much to spend on housing. So let's connect that to transit and Indy Connect, which we talked about earlier. The idea that certain transit options allow for you to reallocate portions of your budget in a way that allow you to expand certain areas. For example, if you're on a transit corridor, you certainly could reduce the number of cars in your household from 2 to 1. And then you can start to allocate that money accordingly to housing. So that's certainly one area. The second area, I think, very prominently is what we do with our various dollars related to housing and reinvesting those dollars. Drive down through the kind of core of the north side through Fall Creek Place. It's a great example of city investment to revitalize, isn't even the word now, because it's now stabilized in Fall Creek Place. And that is now a defined neighborhood in and of itself. So those would be two examples. But I think it's not hoping for what we want the neighborhood to be. It's digging deeper than that and figuring out who wants to come here, why do they want to come here, and how do we understand their budget, and how do we work within that?
And the other thing that I'll offer in terms of a strategy for David's question is what I mentioned earlier about us creating value for these spaces, these underappreciated places becoming the place-making priorities for some of the core stabilization programs and those dollars that we're trying to leverage. Some of the strategies that we have implemented specifically at the CDC are having some realtor roundtables where we literally are inviting realtors into the neighborhood, taking them on tours of our communities where we have rehabbed or rebuilt 25 homes in the last couple of years. We have been able to welcome nearly 20 new families into our neighborhood just in the past 12 to 15 months. And so it's just showing them that there is an option that is valuable for them to start demonstrating when they're looking at that needs assessment with their clients.
We are talking about the future of Indianapolis's neighborhoods here on No Limits. My guests are Adam Tease, is the Director of Indianapolis Metropolitan Development, Lee Riley Evans, Debbie Morris. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, Executive Editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the future of Indianapolis's neighborhoods. My guests are Adam Tease, who is the Director of the Indianapolis Department of Metropolitan Development. I knew I was going to screw one of those up before the hour was over, and the pressure's over now. I'm Lee Riley Evans, who is the Executive Director of the Mapleton Fall Creek Development Corporation, and Debbie Morris, who's with F.C. Tucker and my personal favorite, Metropolitan Indianapolis Board of Realtors, so that there's nothing there alliterative or anything like that that makes it skim off the tongue. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We have gotten an email from a listener named Bob, who says that he's lived on College Avenue in Mapleton Fall Creek for a number of years now, and has witnessed not only an increase in traffic, but also in how fast people drive. The number one complaint from homeowners or those looking for homes in the neighborhood is that drivers drive too fast along College, Central, Pennsylvania, and Delaware. With a street that is more than 90% residential, the city would be doing itself and the homeowners a huge favor by slowing drivers down. Adam, is that possible, and what efforts are being made to deal with Bob's concern?
It's a great question. I would direct his concern to the Department of Public Works, which handles our traffic and engineering related to our roadways. I'm not familiar at all with, right now, that section of College in terms of any discussions on that point. I could certainly have our caller call into Department of Public Works and ask that question.
Lee, since he referenced your neighborhood, is that a major concern in the area?
I honestly am not familiar of that concern along College. I have heard that reference to Fall Creek Parkway. There are often cars traveling in excess of 50 or 60 miles per hour along that stretch we often refer to it as an interstate, because traffic flows so quickly. But on College, I'm not aware of that. I know there are multiple intersections where there's either a stop sign or a four-way stop light, and so there have been some slowing measures put into place for that neighborhood. I by no means dispute his concerns as a resident. He's lived there, so I would support Adam's suggestion to get in touch with DPW to express those concerns or contact the CDC either by our telephone number 923-5514.
Go ahead and give the number. Go ahead. That's fair.
If he wants to call specifically, we'll start having some office hours with the mayor's neighborhood liaison on the 22nd of February. Every Friday, Betty Smith Beecher will be in the office, and so Bob and other residents can come and talk and share their concerns with the city specifically at our office. So If he wants to stop by, he can do that as well.
Okay, and could you give that number one more time?
Sure.
People often, when they're listening. Okay, grab your pencils now.
923-5514, and we're located on the corner of 130 East 30th Street. And like I mentioned, on Friday from 10 to 1, the mayor's neighborhood liaison will be in our offices on a weekly basis to collect those concerns from people like Bob. Okay.
We are talking about the future of Indianapolis's neighborhoods here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Yes, hello, thank you.
Certainly. Your question, please.
I grew up on the south side of Indianapolis, specifically started out in Greenwood, and then we moved further north, and my parents bought a home in University Heights, which is by the University of Indianapolis. And I've known for a long time that the South Side has kind of been the redheaded stepchild of the city in terms of interest and investment. But in the 30 years since I graduated from high school, from Manual High School, and left, that whole area has, in my opinion, really gone downhill. They've lost big box stores. They've lost grocery stores. They've lost, you know, the there used to be a movie theater, and now there's a pawn shop and cigarette selling stores and check cashing places. And I just wonder, you know, there was a comment earlier about the schools being the big attraction. Even when I was in high school in the late 70s, Manuel High School was not a great high school, but it has unfortunately become one of the worst high schools in the state, if not in the country. And I kind of wonder if it's a chicken or an egg thing. Is it, has the neighborhood, has the area gone down because the school has gotten so much significantly worse? Or has the school become significantly worse because that whole area has just been neglected? And my mother still lives down there. I'm concerned for her safety. I don't want her living in that area anymore, even though the little streets where she is seems to be fairly safe. I am very concerned about it. And I was just wondering if there'd be, you know, what is the thinking in terms of the South Side? And I'm not just talking about Fountain Square. I'm talking south down to Thompson Road even. And is there anything in the works in terms of addressing what has been going on that side of Indianapolis for a very, very long time?
We will try to find out. Thanks very much for the call, Catherine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Adam Tease, try not to take personally the fact that you made a reference to red hair there.
Well, no problem.
As the redhead on our panel.
not a problem.
But,
good question.
In terms of good questions, when you've got a neighborhood like that seems to be struggling, you know, what is the appropriate level of intervention? How do you devise a strategy?
Well, let's talk specifically what she brought up. I not only am redheaded, I lived in University Heights the first 3 years of me living in Indianapolis, so I know it well. I know the South Side very well. I think what you look at there is how do you grab onto the anchors that are in place that not only have been there for a long time, but that are emerging as anchors that bring a certain brand quality. And so I'm going to highlight one specifically, and that would be the University of Indianapolis. That institution is taking significant strides right now to becoming a not only educational institution, but a community institution. And what I mean by that, they're becoming, if you will, kind of a stake in the ground on the South Side saying, we're here, we're committed, we're bringing our resources to add brand value to the neighborhoods that surround. The chicken and egg question is exactly that, a chicken and egg question, something we could all spend days
and
talking about. But I think what you do is you try and once again go back to the assets. And the South Side has a lot of them. Garfield Park, University of Indianapolis, 7 minutes to downtown. I'm sure people who spend 50 minutes in their car driving to work to get to their downtown office wouldn't mind seven. So I think you build off the assets. You start to link yourself to the positive institutions and those brand qualities. And frankly, you have to find a way to fix some of the aging housing. That's what happens. Housing ages. It's just how it works. So we have to reach out and find out ways to do that.
Well, and there's something. Yes.
Oh, please. I was just going to say, and you
Lee
also
Riley-Evans.
Work at responding to some of those aging assets, too. I mean, we know that schools have had their ups and downs. I mean, in terms of the quality of education that is provided. And so as residents, we want to make sure that we're challenging the school systems and the school districts and making sure that our residents that are of school age are getting a quality education. And so we make sure that there are some systems put into place to improve those assets, too.
We are talking about the future of Indianapolis's neighborhoods here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten a tweet from Historic Indianapolis says, I hope the history and evolution of the city is included, presumably, in the topics. We can glean much from past success and inspire what can be done in terms of neighborhood revitalization. And that is sort of the other end of the decline of the asset. In some places, you want to preserve those aging buildings and aging structures because they're essential to the character of the neighborhood. How difficult a task is that, Adam Tease?
I think it is less difficult than it maybe once was. We, I think, over the last 40 years have made major strides to identify something that maybe isn't even buildable today in terms of craft and quality. So come to downtown Indianapolis and go to Lockerbie Square and go by the James Whitcomb Riley House and look at certain architectural details that are, in essence, there that are hard to replicate, if not impossible to replicate. So it does say that there are these assets that inherit, but that's not to say that they're easy. I mean, I think that's the difference, is with that preservation, if you will, or reuse, come challenges and come costs. And so you have to have a heart for that character and that quality, and you have to make that have value, because it can't just be because. It has to be because it has value, and that's a tough conversation sometimes.
Debbie Morris, yes, that's a...
Well, yeah, and I would say from the realtor's perspective, I mean, there's a little bit of a sacrifice that you have to make. But so often I'll have clients say, you know, I love the charm of Butler Tarkington or Meridian Kessler, you know, but they want the big yard, they want a guest room, you know, what they built 100 years ago.
They don't want small closets.
Right,
they don't want,
right. Yeah. And you're just not going to have all of that innate charm. There are neighborhoods that have attempted to rebuild that feel, but you're never going to have that same historic feel and charm that you do, you know, in some of our more urban neighborhoods. So that's where there has to be a little give and take on, you know, what you're going to get.
Adam Tease.
And I think what you replace that with is access to significant amenities. That you're near a Garfield Park on the south side. You're near downtown. You're on a transit line. That's the give and take equation, if you will, that you kind of present, the value proposition, if you will.
Exactly. You're near the Children's Museum or some of those other assets.
That is easy. We've also gotten... a couple of tweets from listeners, maybe the same listener who wants to make sure that I catch the question, which is, banks have a responsibility to maintain bank-owned houses to keep them up. What mechanisms are in place to push the banks to, you know, to meet that responsibility? Are the banks held accountable? Adam Tease.
Our Department of Code Enforcement is a very talented group in trying to do everything it can related to that topic. It is not nearly as clear-cut as people would like it to be. It can get very messy very fast in terms of ownership, in terms of how that ownership breaks down, but we try as hard as possible. The reality is 190,000 people left Center Township in the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. What that means is we have a lot of vacant and abandoned housing, and it presents problems and challenges. So it is not as simple as saying, why is someone not doing this? It's a resource question, and I can tell you we have a lot of committed people at the city who I'll get a call at 2 in the morning saying there's an emergency demolition on a house because of a fire, or I'll get a and they're big challenges, and it takes a lot of work. We are a big city related to that topic.
Has that pace accelerated or decelerated over time? Because that's about 4,000 people a year.
Yeah, it's
by my math.
It has decelerated, but hasn't necessarily stopped. Mm-hmm. Center Township lost population in the last census again, so it's a challenge. It's a continued challenge.
Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you for accepting my call.
Certainly. Your question, please.
I wanted to touch that community-oriented policing. I saw it implemented in the Illinois Capitol area where the police brought the horses in order to maybe gratify the children in order to get away from that, oh, my goodness, the police idea that we have. The other thing is, what plans are there to incorporate members in the community in the physical rebuild? Because a sense of ownership might be something that might be helpful. And the last to have you touch on is, what about perhaps ice cream socials? We need to teach these children socialization skills. Too many parents are dropping them off in places, and we as adults need to create environment centers or something where they can come in and we can teach them how to socialize.
Great. Thank you very much for the call, Kevin. We'll try to get your questions answered. Well, we'll start with the sort of how much of this is actually just the community's responsibility. I'll throw that one to Lee, since that's sort of your bailiwick, Lee Riley Evans.
Well, I like his ideas about the community-oriented policing. Mm-hmm. It does involve the community. There has to be a partnership, and it not only be the community's responsibility to enforce the law. We have to have some partners with the police department and IMPD. We have instituted programs such as ice cream socials or other community building initiatives to engage our new residents as well as our existing residents and help attract new people to the neighborhood. It is an ongoing effort. There is no one solution that will solve all of it, and it has to be consistently applied on a regular basis. And so just because you have one neighborhood association meeting doesn't mean that all your problems are going to be solved in that couple of hour discussion.
Ian, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hello.
Certainly. Your question, please.
Yes, I'm interested in opening up a business in a developing neighborhood. I'm just going to see what resources exist to help the city or other groups have to help sort of get that process moving forward.
Good. Thank you very much for the question, Ian. Well, Adam Tease, I'm going to throw that one to you and then maybe also to Debbie Morris.
Yeah, there's actually quite a few resources available to you. I'd encourage you to get in contact with the Department of Metropolitan Development and get on the Google that. That's probably the simplest way rather than a bunch of phone numbers over the radio here. But I'd encourage you to reach out because, believe it or not, the more you might dig, the more you might find those resources available. One of our biggest challenges when it comes to business development is simply matching the entrepreneur with the folks who want to help. It's just a communication gap. It's not that the resources aren't there. Actually, the resources are usually there. So I'd encourage
What sort of resources would we be talking about?
Whether that's small business loans, whether that's workforce development, employment training, and whether that's real estate assistance, which is more kind of the core world I live in terms of property. But those are available, and I'd encourage the caller to dig for them.
Debbie Morris, are there resources you could direct people to?
Well, nothing specific, depending on where you're looking to build. But I live in Broad Ripple, and you've got the Broad Ripple Village Association. You've got Midtown. You have some really strong core groups, and partnering with them is definitely a good strategy.
Yes, Lee.
The only other resource that I would offer is the MidNorthPlan.org. There is a group of...
Go ahead and repeat that. People don't have their pencils.
MidNorthPlan.org. It is a website, and part of the action from that plan is business development. And so there may be a resource for him to connect with through that initiative.
Well, I am afraid we have come to the end of our time together here. I want to apologize to the listeners. I know we've still got calls and we've gotten some emails and Facebook and messages and tweets that I haven't gotten to. I think the solution to this is that we'll all have to have you back at some point to continue the conversation. I'd like to thank my guests, Adam Tease, who is the director of the Indianapolis Department of Metropolitan Development. Adam, thank you for spending this time with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Lee Riley Evans, who is the executive director of the Mapleton Fall Creek Development Corporation. Lee, welcome to. Thank you very much for spending this time.
Over.
Sorry, I was actually moving on to the next part there. Thank you very much for being here.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Certainly. And Debbie Morris, who is with FC Tucker, and I'm just going to say
my boy
to get through.
My boy. Yes.
Thank you very much for spending this time with
pleasure.
Us. We will be back on Thursday when, as I said earlier, we are going to be talking about the future of mass transit. Here in central Indiana. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.